All right, so we've got this intro to PyTorch presentation. Looks like it's from the Data Science Club.
Yeah, looks like a good one.
You're clearly diving deep into PyTorch.
Definitely.
Well, let's make sure this deep dive gives you all the technical details you need.
Great.
So the presentation starts off by, laying out the basics. What is PyTorch? Why is it so popular for deep learning? Let's start there. The slides mention it's open source.
Yeah, developed by Meta's AI Research Lab.
Right. So what makes PyTorch stand out, compared to other frameworks?
I think one of the biggest things is its syntax. It's very Pythonic.
Okay, so if you're already comfortable with Python,
Exactly. It's very intuitive to work with.
makes sense. The slides also mention, let's see, the ability to build complex models,
Yeah, it's very flexible.
a large and active community,
Definitely tons of support and resources.
and support for automatic differentiation.
Right, autocratic.
Can you expand on that? Automatic differentiation,
Yeah,
what's
of
that?
course it's pretty powerful. Oh, absolutely. It's like having a calculus wizard built into the framework. It
Okay.
automatically computes the gradients of your computations,
Right.
which is essential for optimizing the parameters of your models during
So
training.
it's doing all that heavy lifting for you.
It's a huge time saver.
That's got to be helpful. Now, there's also a comparison to TensorFlow.
Right, a classic
Can you
comparison.
give us a rundown of the key differences?
Sure. So historically, TensorFlow relied on static computation graphs,
Okay.
which meant you had to define the entire computational graph before running your code. PyTorch, on the other hand, uses dynamic graphs,
So more flexible.
much more flexible, easier to debug.
And you're building the graph as you execute the code.
Exactly.
Though newer versions of TensorFlow do support dynamic graphs now.
That's true, but PyTorch was really a pioneer in this area.
Interesting. So PyTorch's dynamic approach, that really allows for more experimentation, more iteration.
Absolutely perfect for research and development, when you're trying out different ideas, architectures.
Gotcha. Okay, the presentation then dives into the heart of PyTorch. Tensors.
Yeah, the building blocks of data.
Right, described as like similar to NumPy arrays.
You can think of them that way.
And they even give a simple code example. Torch.tensor, 1, 2, 3.
Very straightforward.
Yeah, looks pretty easy to grasp.
It is.
But the slides point out that even though tensors might look like NumPy arrays, they have some key advantages.
For sure.
Like what?
Well, for one, they can leverage GPUs.
Oh, so that means,
Yeah,
right.
dramatically faster training, especially for those, big deep learning models.
Right.
They also integrate seamlessly with PyTorch's AutoGrad system.
For automatic differentiation.
Yep.
Okay, so it's like tensors are like NumPy arrays, but like souped up for deep learning.
Exactly. They're multidimensional arrays, generalizing vectors and matrices, and they represent data and model parameters in a way that's efficient and compatible with PyTorch's computational engine.
All right, so we've got tensors, the building blocks. What kind of operations can we perform on them?
Well, the presentation covers quite a few, starting with the basics, arithmetic.
Okay, like adding, subtracting.
Yeah, all that. Just like with the NumPy arrays, you can do element-wise addition, subtraction, multiplication, division.
Gotcha. But deep learning is all about matrices, right?
Right.
How does PyTorch handle those?
Makes it super simple.
Okay.
You can use the at operator or the torch.matmul function. Very intuitive, very readable.
Okay, and what about reshaping tensors? Sometimes you got to adjust the dimensions to feed the data into a neural network.
Absolutely. PyTorch has functions like view and reshape just for that.
Gotcha.
They give you tons of flexibility in manipulating the shape of your tensors.
Makes sense. And it looks like slicing and indexing tensors is pretty similar to NumPy as well.
It is. PyTorch carries over that familiar syntax.
All right, so we've created our tensors, done some operations, reshaped them. Now, how do we get this data into our models?
Right.
Especially with those large data sets, efficiency is key.
Absolutely. You don't want data loading to be a bottleneck. That's where PyTorch's data loader class comes in.
Okay, so the slides break it down into two main parts, data set and data loader. Can you walk us through that?
Sure. The dataset class represents your dataset, how to access the samples. You can use built-in datasets from PyTorch
Okay.
or create your own. You just subclass dataset and define a couple methods, let in get item.
Okay, and then data loader takes that data set object and handles the loading.
It handles all the details, loading the batches, shuffling, and it can even load the data in parallel.
Using multiple worker processes.
Exactly.
Okay, so the presentation also emphasizes batch size and shuffling during training.
Yeah, very important concepts.
Why are those so crucial?
Well, the batch size determines how many samples are processed at once. Picking the right batch size can impact both training speed and the model's ability to generalize.
Okay. and shuffling.
That's all about randomizing the order of your data. Prevents the model from just memorizing the order it sees things in.
So it forces it to actually learn the underlying patterns.
Precisely.
Now the slides start connecting things to logistic regression,
Right.
and they describe neural networks as kind of like an extension of that,
It's a good way to think about it.
with multiple logistic regressions operating in parallel.
Each neuron in the network can be thought of as a logistic regression unit, taking inputs, applying weights, and producing an output. And when you stack layers of those neurons, that's when the network can learn those complex patterns.
They have a cool visual example showing that simple logistic regression, you're limited to a linear decision boundary.
Yeah.
Whereas a neural network, you can get all those crazy non-linear boundaries.
Much more expressive.
So we've got this idea of neural networks. How does PyTorch actually represent these networks in code?
Well, it represents them as sequences of layers.
Okay.
And each layer performs a specific transformation on the data. You might have fully connected layers, convolutional layers, recurrent layers, and so on.
And I'm guessing those activation functions like ReLU and sigmoid, those are sprinkled throughout.
Absolutely, those are essential. They introduce the non-linearity, which is crucial for letting those networks learn complex functions.
Okay.
Without them, it would just be, one big linear transformation, no matter how many layers you have.
Right. And PyTorch has this torch.nn module.
Your go-to toolkit for building networks in PyTorch.
Gotcha. So how do you actually define a neural network?
It's pretty straightforward.
Okay.
PyTorch uses a class-based approach. You define a class that inherits from n.module.
All right.
You define your layers in the init method and then specify how data flows through those layers in the forward method.
And they even have a nice little example
Yep.
showing a simple network with two fully connected layers
Yeah, a good starting point.
with a ReLU activation function after the first layer.
Once you understand that basic pattern, you can build much more complex architectures.
All right, so now let's talk about the training process.
Okay.
The slides lay out PyTorch's training loop as having five main steps.
A clear, concise process.
First, you have the forward pass.
You're sending the input data through the model. Get those predictions.
Then you compute the loss.
Yeah, measuring how far off your predictions are from the true values.
And then, let's see, next you have to zero the gradients.
Yeah, important step.
Why is that necessary?
Because those gradients, they accumulate during training. So by zeroing them before each backward pass, you're making sure that the gradients that are used to update the weights are only based on the current batch of data.
Okay, so you're not mixing gradients from different batches.
Exactly. That would mess up the optimization process.
Makes sense. All right, then we've got the backward pass.
That's where the magic of backpropagation happens.
Right, that's where you're calculating those gradients.
The loss with respect to each of the model parameters.
And finally, you update the model's weights.
You use an optimizer for that.
Right, and that optimizer uses those computed gradients to adjust the parameters to minimize the loss.
Exactly.
Now, they also have this handy little code snippet showing that training loop.
Yeah, a good concrete
It's
example.
iterating over epochs.
Complete passes through the training data.
It performs those five steps for each batch of data.
Makes it really clear how these concepts translate into code.
All right, now let's dig a little deeper into those loss functions.
They're key to guiding the learning process.
So, what exactly are they?
A way to measure how well your model's predictions line up with the true labels.
Okay, and PyTorch has all those built-in loss functions in the torch.n module.
A whole bunch, lots of different options for different tasks.
Right.
Well, for classification tasks, cross-entropy loss is popular.
Combines log softmax and negative log likelihood loss.
Right. And for regression, where you're predicting those continuous values, MSE loss, mean squared error, is commonly used.
And then there are others.
Yeah, like L1 loss, which looks at absolute differences, and binary cross entropy, which is used for binary classification problems.
So picking the right loss function for your specific task.
Crucial. One of the most important decisions you'll make. It's telling your model what it should be aiming for during training.
Now let's talk about this backpropagation. It's kind of like the core of how those neural networks actually learn, right?
It is. It's the algorithm that efficiently computes those gradients of the loss function with respect to each of those model parameters. Those gradients tell us how much each parameter contributed to the error, and then we use them to adjust those parameters to try and reduce that error.
And PyTorch makes this whole thing much easier.
Oh, for sure. The backward function, that handles all the complicated calculus for you.
So it calculates all the gradients and populates the dot grad attribute for each tensor. Now, the slides introduce autograd. The automatic differentiation module.
Yeah, this is a game changer.
Sounds like it. So how does AutoGrad work?
It's pretty cool, actually. AutoGrad keeps track of all the operations that you perform on tensors that have the requires grad true flag set.
Okay.
It's basically building this computational graph under the hood. And when you call the backward function, it uses that graph to efficiently calculate the gradients.
So PyTorch is basically doing all that complex calculus for you.
Right, automatically. It makes working with these deep learning models much more intuitive.
Focus on the model, define the loss function, AutoGrad takes care of the rest.
Exactly.
Amazing. And there's a code example showing how AutoGrad works. You can create those tensors, perform operations, and then see the gradients through that dot grad attribute.
Yeah, see it in action.
Now, once you have those gradients, you need a way to use them to update the model's parameters. That's where optimizers come in.
Right. They take those computed gradients and adjust the model parameters, all with the goal of minimizing the loss function.
And PyTorch, it provides various optimizers in its torch.optim module.
It does. Some popular ones are SGD, Atom, ArmSprop.
SGD, stochastic gradient descent. That's sort of the classic one.
Yeah, it's been around for a while. Updates the model parameters based on the learning rate and momentum.
And Atom, or adaptive moment estimation. That was pretty popular too, right?
Very popular. It adjusts the learning rate for each parameter individually, often leads to faster convergence.
Okay, and ArmSprop is another one.
It's a variant of SGD that scales the learning rate based on recent gradients.
So each optimizer has its own strengths.
It does. Which one you choose kind of depends on the specific problem you're trying to solve.
And then there's the learning rate.
Right, that's a crucial hypoparameter. Controls how big of a step the optimizer takes during each update.
Yeah, tuning that learning rate can be a bit of an art.
It is. You got to experiment a little to find that sweet spot. The presentation even shows how to initialize an SGD optimizer. You specify the learning rate and momentum.
Helpful to see how easy it is to get started with different optimizers.
It is.
Now, let's shift gears a bit, talk about speed. Training these deep learning models can take a lot of time.
It can, especially on large data sets.
That's where those GPUs come in.
Yeah, the workhorses of deep learning.
GPUs or graphics processing units, they're designed for that parallel processing.
They make those computations so much faster than CPUs.
And PyTorch, it makes it easy to take advantage of those GPUs.
It does. It supports GPU acceleration through CUDA.
Okay. And you can check if you have a GPU available.
Yeah, with torch.q.ai is available.
And then move your model and data to the GPU.
With .2 device.
So, with a few lines of code, you can really speed things up.
Significantly, especially important for those large data sets, those complex models. It can make a huge difference.
Okay, we've covered a lot of ground: tensors, neural networks, training loops, those loss functions, optimizers,
We have.
even GPU acceleration. Now the presentation moves on to convolutional neural networks, CNNs. Those are especially powerful for things like image recognition.
They're designed to automatically learn those meaningful features from images, making them incredibly useful for all sorts of computer vision tasks.
The slides introduce this idea of a sliding window.
Key concept.
Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. Imagine you've got this small window, sometimes called a kernel or filter, sliding across an image.
Okay.
This window, it performs a convolution operation. It's essentially extracting features from that local region.
Okay.
By sliding it over the entire image, that's how the CNN builds up a representation of the image's features.
So those CNNs, by stacking multiple layers, they can learn this hierarchy of features, right?
Exactly. Going from simple edges and textures in the early layers to more complex objects and patterns in the later layers.
It's like they learn to see the world similar to how we do.
It is building up that understanding from simple components to more complex ones. And there's a diagram showing this hierarchy of features. You can actually see what those early layers are picking up, those simple patterns, and then how the later layers start to recognize those more complex structures.
That's pretty cool. All right, so we've built this powerful CNN, trained it. Now we want to save it, right?
Right. Don't want to start from scratch every time.
No, definitely not. So, how do we save that model in PyTorch?
PyTorch makes that very straightforward. You save the model's parameters using torch.save. That saves the model's state dictionary, which has all those learned weights and biases.
And to reload it, you just create a new instance of the model
Exactly.
and load that state dictionary using torch.load.
It's very simple, very efficient way to store and retrieve those models.
PyTorch gives you a lot of flexibility in how you save and manage those models.
It does, designed to be user-friendly and fit into different workflows.
Okay, so that was a pretty deep dive into the core concepts of PyTorch. from those tensors and neural networks to training, optimizing, and even saving those models.
We've covered a lot, but we're just getting
So I'm
started.
ready for more.
Now that we've got those fundamentals down, let's dig into some of the more specialized aspects of PyTorch, starting with those convolutional neural networks.
Okay, CNNs.
We touched on them a bit
Yeah,
earlier,
just briefly.
but they really deserve a closer look, especially for computer vision.
Right. The slides mention they're designed to extract features from visual data.
Like images.
Images, right. They use those filters or kernels sliding across the input image, doing those convolutions. Can you walk us through how that actually works?
Sure. So think of the filter as like a small matrix of weights.
Okay.
As this filter slides across the image, it's performing a dot product with the pixels, the corresponding pixels in the image. And that gives you a single value.
Right.
And that value represents the activation of that filter at that specific location.
So it's like the filter is looking for a particular pattern
Exactly, detecting specific features.
in that local region of the image.
And by having multiple filters in a convolutional layer, each tuned to detect different patterns, that's how the CNN can capture a diverse set of features.
Okay, I see. The presentation also talks about this hierarchical feature extraction.
It's one of the key advantages of CNNs.
So how does that work?
So as you stack more and more of these convolutional layers, each layer starts to learn to detect increasingly complex features.
Okay.
So like the first layer might just detect those simple edges, those gradients.
Yeah, like basic shapes.
Right, but then subsequent layers combine those basic features to recognize more complex shapes, textures, and eventually, whole objects.
So it's like they're building up an understanding of the image.
It's very similar to how our own visual system works.
Starting with those simple building blocks and then recognizing more and more complex things.
Exactly. And the slides even have that diagram illustrating this hierarchy. You can see what those early layers are picking up and how the later layers, recognize those more complex structures.
It's cool to see what the network is actually learning.
It is. It gives you a better understanding of how CNNs actually work.
Now, what about those pooling layers? Those seem to be like sprinkled between those convolutional layers.
Yeah, they're important.
What do those do?
So pooling layers, like max pooling or average pooling, they downsample the feature maps.
The ones produced by those convolutional layers.
Right. And that serves a couple of purposes.
Okay.
First, it reduces the dimensionality of the feature maps, which makes computation more efficient.
All right, so it makes things run faster.
And second, it makes the features more robust.
Robust. Like, what do you mean?
Robust to small variations in position. So, for instance, with max pooling, you just take the maximum value within a small neighborhood of the feature map.
Okay.
That means even if a feature is shifted a little bit, that max pooled representation will still capture it.
Gotcha. So it's less sensitive to noise.
Exactly.
Okay. And after all those convolutional and pooling layers, it looks like we usually have those fully connected layers at the end of the network.
Right, those are important too.
What do those do?
So those fully connected layers, they take those high-level features that have been extracted by all those convolutional and pooling layers,
Okay.
and they use them to make the final classification.
Gotcha.
They're essentially learning a linear combination of those features to map them to the desired output classes.
So you've got this pipeline, convolutional layers for feature extraction, pooling layers to downsample and make things robust,
Right.
and fully connected layers for the final prediction. All right, that makes sense.
Yeah, a common pattern in CNNs.
The slides also mention this transfer learning.
Yes, a very powerful technique.
Sounds like a way to leverage those existing models.
It is. Transfer learning is all about taking a model that's already been pre-trained.
Pre-trained, like on a different data set.
Yeah, usually a huge data set like ImageNet, and then fine-tuning it on your specific task.
Okay.
The idea is that pre-trained model has already learned a lot of useful features.
That can be generalized. So
Exactly.
you're giving your model a head start.
That's right. It can save you a ton of time and data.
Makes sense. And PyTorch has this model zoo.
Yep, makes transfer learning super convenient.
It's a collection of pre-trained models.
For all sorts of tasks, you just download one that's relevant to your problem, fine-tune it on your own data. Great resource.
Okay, moving on. The presentation switches to recurrent neural networks, RNNs. Those seem to be like specifically for sequential data.
Right, they excel at processing data where the order of the elements actually matters.
Okay.
They have this unique ability to maintain an internal state, that captures information from previous elements.
So they're looking back in time.
Exactly. They can learn temporal dependencies.
So that makes them good for things like time series analysis,
Perfect for that.
natural language processing.
Yep. where the order of the words is obviously crucial.
And speech recognition.
Right. The order of the sounds matters there too.
So can you give us a little more detail on how RNNs actually work?
Sure. Think of an RNN as this network that's processing the input sequence step by step.
Okay.
At each step, it gets the current input, but it also gets this internal state from the previous step.
Right.
And that internal state, that's what carries the information about what the network has seen so far.
So it has a memory.
Exactly, a short-term memory. And that allows it to make predictions that take that context into account.
That's pretty cool. Now, the slides mentioned some specific types of RNNs, LSTMs, and GRUs.
Yeah, those are special flavors of RNNs.
What makes them different?
So LSTMs, long short-term memory networks, and GRUs, gated recurrent units, those were designed to address a problem that standard RNNs have, the vanishing gradient problem.
Okay, and that can make training difficult.
Exactly. These LSTMs and GRUs, they have these more sophisticated mechanisms for controlling the flow of information.
Over time.
Right, so they're better at learning those long-range dependencies.
So they're like souped up RNNs.
That's one way to think about it. They've become really popular for NLP tasks, you know, where sentences can be quite long.
Right.
And the meaning of a word might depend on something that appeared much earlier. And they even provide a code snippet showing how to define a simple RNN in PyTorch.
It's pretty straightforward.
It is. PyTorch makes it very easy to work with all sorts of RNNs, providing layers like RNN, LSTM, and GRU in that torch.nn module.
Nice. Okay, we've got CNNs for visual data, RNNs for sequential data. What about these transformers we hear so much about these days?
Ah, transformers. Those are a relatively new architecture, but they've really revolutionized NLP.
What's so special about them?
Well, they rely on this mechanism called attention.
Attention.
Yeah, it allows them to selectively focus on different parts of the input sequence.
Okay.
So instead of processing the sequence in a strictly sequential manner, like those RNNs do,
No.
the transformer can kind of jump around and pay attention to the most relevant words.
Regardless of their position.
Exactly.
That sounds pretty powerful.
It is. Makes them especially good for things like machine translation. You know, where the order of the words in the original language and the target language might be totally different.
Right, that makes sense. The slides do give an overview of the transformer architecture. They show the encoder, decoder, attention mechanism. Seems pretty complex.
It is a complex architecture, but PyTorch makes working with them much easier.
Okay.
It has a dedicated module for that, torch.nn transformer. You don't have to implement all the details yourself.
That's a relief. Now, the presentation shifts gears a bit and talks about performance optimization.
Yeah, always important.
They start off with batch normalization.
Ah, a classic technique. It can really speed up training.
And it can also improve the stability of those neural networks.
It does. Basically, it normalizes the activations of each layer during training.
Okay.
That helps to prevent those gradients from exploding or vanishing.
So it keeps things running smoothly.
Exactly. Helps the training process stay on track. And PyTorch, it's easy to add batch normalization to your models. You've got batch norm kdim for convolutional networks, batch norm 1-2 for those fully connected networks.
Convenient. They also discuss dropout.
Another important technique.
That's for preventing overfitting, right?
That's right. During training, dropout randomly drops out some of the neurons,
Okay.
and that forces the network to learn more robust features.
So it's not relying too heavily on any single neuron.
Exactly.
Kind of like training an ensemble of networks where each network sees a slightly different view of the data.
You could think of it that way. And dropout, that helps the model generalize better to unseen data, prevents it from memorizing the training set.
Okay, makes sense. And PyTorch has the dropout layer.
Yep, just specify the dropout probability.
The chance that a neuron will be dropped out.
Exactly. And of course, there's GPU acceleration, which we talked about earlier. That's a game changer for training these models.
Yeah, offloading those computations to the GPU can really reduce that training time. PyTorch has that seamless support for it through CUDA.
You can easily move your model and data to the GPU.
With that data device method.
Right. They also talk about early stopping, which can also save you time.
Early stopping, what's that?
So you monitor the model's performance on a validation set during training.
Okay.
If that performance starts to plateau or decline, you just stop training early.
So you're preventing the model from overfitting.
Exactly. It's a simple but effective technique.
Makes sense. Okay, so you've trained your model, but now you need to know how well it's doing.
Right, model evaluation, crucial step.
How do we evaluate those classification models in PyTorch?
So there are a few common metrics. Accuracy is probably the simplest one.
Just what percentage of samples were classified correctly?
Exactly. Then you've got precision, which looks at how many of the samples that were predicted as positive were actually positive,
Okay.
and recall, which measures how many of the actual positive samples were correctly identified.
And then the F1 score combines those two.
That's right. It's the harmonic mean of precision and recall. It's a good metric to use when you want to balance both, especially if you're dealing with an imbalanced data set.
Gotcha. And they mentioned metrics for regression tasks as well, like mean squared error, MSE, and mean absolute error, MAE.
Right. MSE, that measures the average squared difference between the predicted values and the true values.
So it penalizes larger errors more.
Exactly. MAE, on the other hand, just looks at the average absolute difference.
So it's a bit more robust.
You could say that. Which metric you use really depends on your application and how much you want to penalize those large errors.
Okay, so we've trained our model, evaluated its performance. Now we want to share it with others or deploy it into a production system. How does that work in PyTorch?
Well, PyTorch makes deploying models fairly straightforward. For simple cases, you can just save that trained model and load it into a Python script, one that uses it to make predictions. But for more complex deployments where you might need to integrate the model into a non-Python environment,
Yeah, like a web application or something.
right, PyTorch provides the torch.jit module.
And that lets you convert the model.
Yes, you can trace or script your model, basically creating a serialized representation that can be loaded and executed in other environments.
So it's not tied to Python anymore.
Exactly. You can use it in C++ or Java.
So PyTorch gives you that flexibility.
It does.
What about debugging? These models can get pretty complex, things can go wrong.
Oh, absolutely. Debugging deep learning models can be tricky, but PyTorch has tools to help.
Okay, good.
One of the best is the PyTorch debugger.
A debugger.
Yeah, you can step through your code, inspect variables, track the flow of data, like an X-ray into your model.
That sounds really useful. The slides also mention like printing intermediate
Yeah, so
outputs,
that can help pinpoint issues.
like the activations of different
See
layers.
if they're in the expected range.
Right, make sure they make sense.
And visualizing the model's weights and biases can be helpful for understanding what the model's learned.
And spotting potential problems.
Exactly. PyTorch integrates well with visualization libraries like TensorBoard.
You can create all sorts of plots and graphs.
Of the model's internal state, it's really helpful. Debugging often requires a combination of techniques, but with the right tools, you can usually track those bugs down.
Okay, so now the presentation talks about PyTorch's ecosystem.
Yeah, it's quite extensive.
So, what are some of the key libraries and tools that people should know about?
Well, there are a ton, but one important one is Torch Vision.
Torch vision, okay.
That one's a must-have for computer vision tasks.
What does it provide?
It has data sets, model architectures, image transformations, all specifically designed for computer vision. And it has pre-trained models for things like image classification, object detection, segmentation.
So you can use those pre-trained models or build on top of them.
Exactly. Great way to save time.
Okay. What about NLP? Any libraries for that?
Yeah, Torch Text, another essential library. It provides all the tools you need for working with text data, data sets, tokenizers, those pre-trained word embeddings.
Sounds comprehensive.
Yeah.
And then there's PyTorch Lightning.
Ah, PyTorch Lightning,
That
yeah.
one seems to be a higher level framework.
It is built on top of PyTorch.
What's its purpose?
It simplifies the process of training and managing those PyTorch models, handles a lot of the boilerplate code,
Okay.
provides a more organized approach. Especially helpful for larger projects, research settings, keeps things manageable.
Makes sense. And we can't forget those visualization tools.
Right, weights and biases, TensorBoard. Essential for monitoring your training progress, debugging, analyzing your models. You can track those metrics, visualize those model architectures, even analyze those gradients flowing through the network.
Really helps you understand what's happening inside.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got all these great tools and libraries, but tools are only as good as the people using them, right?
Absolutely, that's where the community comes in.
PyTorch has a pretty active community.
It does, a thriving and supportive community.
Where can people go for help and to connect with other users?
Well, the official PyTorch website is a great starting point.
Okay.
It has documentation, tutorials, examples.
And the forums.
Yeah, the PyTorch forums are fantastic for asking questions, getting help.
And learning from others.
Exactly. There are also online courses and tutorials.
Like deeplearning.ai, fast.ai.
Those are great options for structured learning paths.
And then there's GitHub.
Tons of code examples, models, implementations, the official PyTorch repository, and a whole bunch of community-driven projects. a treasure trove of resources.
So with all that, PyTorch is designed to empower developers and researchers.
It is.
Now, the presentation starts to dive into some specific applications of PyTorch,
Right.
starting with natural language processing.
NLP, that's a huge field, all about enabling computers to understand, interpret, and generate human language.
And PyTorch has really become a powerful tool for that,
It has, thanks to its flexibility in libraries like TorchText.
which we talked about earlier.
Right. One of the fundamental tasks in NLP is text classification.
Where you're assigning a label to a piece of text.
Exactly. It could be categorizing emails as spam or not spam, labeling news articles by topic, things like that.
And PyTorch has all the pieces for building those models.
It does. You can use embedding layers to represent words as vectors,
Okay.
recurrent layers like LSTMs to process those sequences of words, and fully connected layers to do the final classification.
Sounds like a powerful combination. What about machine translation?
PyTorch is great for that too. You can use those sequence-to-sequence models.
Okay.
You've got an encoder that processes the input sequence and a decoder that generates the output sequence.
And you can experiment with different architectures for both of those.
Yeah, RNNs, LSTMs, even transformers. PyTorch gives you the flexibility to design and build state-of-the-art translation systems.
All right, so PyTorch is a powerhouse for NLP. What about computer vision?
Well, given PyTorch's strengths in handling images and those tensors, it's a natural fit for computer vision.
It's really revolutionized the field.
It has, giving researchers and practitioners this powerful and flexible framework for all sorts of image and video tasks.
One of the most basic tasks is image classification.
Right, assigning a label to an image. Like, is this a picture of a cat, a dog, a bird?
And PyTorch makes it easy to build those models.
It does. Using those convolutional neural networks, CNNs we discussed earlier, you just stack those convolutional layers, pooling layers, fully connected layers. You can create some powerful models that way. Models that can learn to recognize really complex visual patterns.
And they even provide those pre-trained models.
Yeah, in the model zoo, no need to start from scratch.
It saves a lot of time. Now, what about object detection?
Ah, yes, object detection. That's where you're not only identifying those objects, but also locating them in the image.
With bounding boxes.
Exactly. PyTorch has different architectures for that. YOLO, SSD, faster RCNN, each with their own advantages. They often combine convolutional layers for that feature extraction, region proposal networks for proposing those object locations, and then those classification heads for actually classifying the objects.
Sounds like PyTorch has a pretty comprehensive toolkit for computer vision,
It
both
does.
image classification and object detection.
And it goes beyond those basic tasks too. PyTorch is used for things like image segmentation, where you label each pixel in an image, and video analysis, where you're extracting information from a sequence of frames.
So its flexibility is a big advantage.
Absolutely. It can handle images, it can handle sequences, makes it really versatile.
Okay, let's switch gears again and talk about generative models.
Ah, generative models, those are
It's
exciting.
like teaching a computer to be creative.
It is. They can create new data samples that look like the training data. So, a generative model trained on images of faces could generate new realistic faces. Or a model trained on text could generate new text that reads like it was written by a human.
Pretty mind-blowing.
It is. And PyTorch provides the tools to implement all sorts of generative models. JANs, generative adversarial networks, and VAEs, variational autoencoders, those are two popular approaches.
So, can you tell us a bit more about those?
Sure. JANs, those consist of two competing networks.
Competing.
Yeah, you've got the generator that tries to create realistic looking data, and the discriminator that tries to tell the difference between the real data and the generated
So
data.
they're battling it out.
They're trained adversarially, pushing each other to get better and better.
Until the generator can create stuff that's indistinguishable from the real thing.
Exactly. And through that process, those JANs can learn to generate some amazing outputs.
It's like a cat and mouse game.
It is very creative.
Okay, what about VAEs?
VAEs, they take a different approach. They learn a latent representation of the data.
Latent
It's
representation.
like a compressed encoding of the data, capturing the essential features, and they use that representation to generate new samples. VAEs, they offer a bit more control over the generated samples.
So it's JANs.
Yeah, you can manipulate the latent variables to guide the generation process.
Interesting. So PyTorch gives you the tools for both JANs and VAEs.
It does, it's a versatile framework.
Okay, let's move on to reinforcement learning.
Ah, reinforcement learning, RL, that's another exciting area.
It's like training a dog with treats, right?
Exactly. You have an agent that learns to interact with an environment. and it tries to maximize a reward signal.
So the dog does tricks to get treats.
Right, learns to avoid actions that lead to punishment.
And PyTorch has libraries for RL.
It does. Torch.RL, Stable Baselines 3, those are a couple of popular ones. They provide implementations of all sorts of algorithms, queue learning, deep queue networks, DQNs, proximal policy optimization, PPO, and environments for training those agents.
So you can get up and running pretty quickly.
You can. Queue learning, that's about learning a queue function, which estimates the expected reward.
For taking a particular action in a given state.
Right. And DQN, that uses deep neural networks to approximate that queue function.
And PPO is a newer algorithm.
Relatively new, yeah, but it's become popular, known for its stability and efficiency, used for things like game playing and robotics. PyTorch's flexibility and GPU support make it a great platform for RL.
All right, so we've covered some key areas where PyTorch is being used.
We have.
Now, how about some real-world applications?
Well, PyTorch's versatility has led to its adoption in a ton of different industries: healthcare, finance, automotive, entertainment, you name it.
So, specific examples.
Sure. In healthcare, PyTorch is being used to analyze medical images, things like X-rays, CT scans, MRIs, helping with diagnosis and treatment planning.
So it's helping doctors make better
It
decisions.
is. CNNs are really good at detecting those subtle abnormalities in images, you know, things that a human eye might miss.
So it can lead to earlier diagnosis.
Exactly, better outcomes. PyTorch is also being used in drug discovery.
Drug discovery, wow.
Yep, those generative models are being used to design new molecules, molecules with desired properties. Could really speed up the development of new treatments.
That's incredible. What about finance?
Finance is another big one. PyTorch is used to fight fraud, assess risk, make those investment decisions.
So it's helping to keep our money safe.
It is. RNNs are great for analyzing those time series data, like stock prices, market trends, trying to predict those future movements.
Makes sense. And in the automotive industry.
PyTorch is a major force behind those self-driving cars.
That's a big one.
It is. CNNs are used to process data from cameras, LiDAR, all those sensors.
So the car can understand its surroundings.
Exactly. And RL, that's being used to train those self-driving car agents to navigate, handle all those different driving scenarios.
That's pretty amazing.
It is. PyTorch is also used for NLP, building those chatbots, machine translation systems, text summarization tools. And in entertainment, it's used for those realistic special effects in movies and games.
So PyTorch has this really broad impact on the world
It does, and it's only going to grow.
as deep learning advances.
Exactly. But we have to be mindful of the ethical considerations.
Right. With great power comes great responsibility.
Exactly. As these models get more powerful, more widespread, it's crucial that we use them responsibly.
So what are some of the main concerns?
Well, one of the big ones is bias. If the training data reflects existing societal biases, then the model can learn and perpetuate those biases.
That could lead to some unfair outcomes.
It could, discriminatory outcomes. So it's important to be aware of those potential biases in the data.
And to try to mitigate them.
Right, you might need to curate the data carefully, balance the representation of different groups, or adjust the model's objective function to discourage those biased predictions.
Makes sense. What else should people be thinking about?
Explainability. As these models get more complex, it can be harder to understand why they make a certain decision.
That could be a problem in areas like healthcare or finance.
Absolutely, anywhere where you need to be able to justify the model's predictions.
So we need ways to make these models more transparent.
We do, and there's a lot of research happening in that area, explainable AI. We're starting to see techniques that can shed light on how these models make their decisions.
It's important to continue developing those
It
techniques.
is. We need to make sure those deep learning models are not only powerful, but also transparent and accountable.
All right, so we've covered a lot of ground in this PyTorch deep dive,
We have.
explored its core features, its ecosystem, its applications, even those ethical considerations. So, as we head into the final part of our deep dive,
Okay.
what are some key takeaways you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I think the main takeaway is that PyTorch is a really powerful, versatile framework for deep learning, great for both research and production.
And it's Pythonic.
Yeah, that makes it easy to work with those dynamic computation graphs, all those tools and functions. It's really enjoyable.
And that ecosystem is a huge advantage.
It is. With all those libraries, the active community, all those resources, It really empowers developers and researchers. But it's important to remember, deep learning is a rapidly evolving field.
So we need to keep learning.
Exactly. PyTorch is evolving right along with it. New features, new libraries, new applications, they're popping up all the time. So stay curious, keep learning, and embrace those challenges.
Deep learning is an exciting field.
It is full of opportunities.
Okay, so before we move on to the final part of our deep dive, let's take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment to explore some of those more advanced concepts and cutting-edge research that's really pushing the boundaries.
Okay, so welcome back. Let's jump into some more of those advanced concepts and techniques in PyTorch. We'll start with a closer look at that autograd system.
Yeah, AutoGrad, the engine behind all that automatic differentiation.
It is one of the most powerful features of PyTorch, but it can be a bit mysterious.
Definitely. Can you demystify it a little bit?
I'll try. So, at its heart, autograd is all about tracking those operations on tensors, and it builds up this computational graph representing those operations.
Okay.
Each node in that graph, that's a tensor,
Right.
and each edge represents an operation performed on that tensor.
So it's like as PyTorch runs your code, it's keeping track of everything.
It is building up this graph in the background, and when you call that backward method on a tensor,
Right.
PyTorch, it goes through this graph, applying the chain rule to calculate the
So it's
gradients.
like a domino effect.
Kind of, the gradients flow backwards through the graph, from the output tensor all the way back to the input tensors.
Makes sense. Now, there's this requires a grad flag.
Right, very
I
important.
remember seeing that in some of the code examples.
It's how you tell PyTorch which tensors to compute gradients for.
Okay.
By default, those tensors are created with requires grad false.
So AutoGrad doesn't track them.
Exactly, it ignores them. But if you set it to true, autograd starts tracking everything, all those operations on that tensor and its descendants in the graph.
So if you're optimizing a model's parameters,
Right.
those parameters need to have requires grade.
They do. Otherwise, no gradients, no updates during training. The presentation is a good example showing autograd in action, creating those tensors, performing operations, accessing those gradients, really illustrates how it all works.
Yeah, it's a pretty seamless process.
It is really well integrated into PyTorch.
Now, sometimes you might want to control the flow of gradients.
Right, you don't always want them flowing everywhere.
So, like, why would you want to stop them?
Well, let's say you're using a pre-trained model and you only want to fine-tune certain layers. You can freeze the gradients for the other layers. Or maybe you're implementing a custom loss function. You might need to tweak those gradients a bit.
To make sure they're propagating correctly.
Exactly. PyTorch gives you a few ways to do this. You can use the detach method to detach a tensor from the graph. No gradients flowing through there. Or you can use the NoGrad context manager to temporarily turn off gradient tracking.
And for those really fine-grained control situations.
You can use the torch.autograd.function class. Define custom operations. You have your own forward and backward methods. Complete control over how those gradients are calculated.
So some powerful tools there for those advanced users. Okay, let's talk about custom data loading. PyTorch has that data loader class, which is great.
It is handles a lot of common scenarios.
But what if you have a data set that's a bit more unique, or you need a special loading pipeline?
That's where custom data loading comes in. PyTorch lets you create your own data loaders.
Tailored to your needs.
Exactly. You just subclass those torch.utils.data dataset and torch.utils.data data loader classes.
Okay, so the dataset class, that's representing your dataset, giving you a way to access those individual samples.
Right, you need to implement a couple of methods. The len method tells you the size of the dataset.
And the getIDA method.
That's the one that returns a single sample, given its index.
And then data loader, that takes a dataset object and handles the iteration, the batching, the shuffling, and can even load things in parallel.
Right, those worker processes.
So if you need to do some special pre-processing or data augmentation, you can handle that in the dataset class.
You can, lots of flexibility there.
Okay, now how about distributed training?
Ah, that's becoming more and more important.
As these models and datasets get bigger and bigger.
Exactly. You need to be able to train across multiple GPUs, multiple machines even.
Right, make things faster.
PyTorch has great support for that, the torch.distributed package.
And what does that provide?
A whole set of tools, for coordinating communication and synchronization between those processes running on different devices. You can implement data parallelism.
Where each process gets a subset of the data.
Right. Or model parallelism, where each process gets a piece of the model. It's a complex topic, but PyTorch makes it manageable.
Good to know. All right, so we've covered AutoGrad, data loading, distributed training. Now let's touch on some of the more cutting-edge stuff,
Okay, sounds good.
like meta learning.
Meta learning, that's learning to learn.
It is, you're training models to quickly adapt to new tasks.
With minimal data, instead of training for a specific task, you're training it to solve a variety of tasks.
So it's like giving the model a toolbox.
Exactly. It's closely related to few-shot learning, where the model needs to learn from just a few examples. PyTorch is a great tool for research and meta learning.
Because of that flexibility, those dynamic graphs.
Exactly. Another cutting-edge area is graph neural networks, GNNs.
GNNs, okay.
Those are designed to work with graph-structured data.
Which is becoming more and more common.
It is social networks, recommendations, drug discovery.
Right. And those GNNs, they can operate on that irregular graph-like data.
They can, unlike those traditional networks that work on fixed size inputs.
Like images or sequences.
Right. GNNs can learn those complex relationships within that graph data,
So they're used for things like node classification, link prediction.
even graph generation. And PyTorch Geometric is a popular extension for working with graphs and building those GNNs.
So PyTorch is really being used to push the boundaries of deep learning.
It is, and it's exciting to see those new applications emerge in areas like meta learning and GNNs. But remember, this is just the beginning.
Right, we've only scratched the surface.
Deep learning is a huge field, constantly evolving. There's always more to learn. Hopefully, this deep dive has given you a good foundation and maybe sparked your curiosity to keep exploring.
Yeah, PyTorch is such a versatile and powerful framework.
It is. You can use it to solve all sorts of problems. So keep experimenting, keep learning, and keep pushing the boundaries of what's possible.
And if you ever get stuck, remember that community is there to help.
Exactly. It's a great resource. So go out there, build something amazing, and never stop learning.
Well said.